From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the fallout from Deflategate continues. Next stop, possibly the Supreme Court.
The truth is that the Republic won't rise and fall on it. But I think this is a question of contract law versus individual rights.
Plus, author Susan Faludi got a surprising email a few years ago from her father. He was now a she.
After 25 years of not speaking to each other, and we began the long process of getting to know each other.
Also today, the science behind the Ghostbusters reboot.
We have dedicated our whole lives to studying the paranormal. Now there's sightings all over the city.
An MIT physicist on getting proton packs right.
I ain't afraid of no ghosts.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Who can you call?
Ghostbusters!
An invisible man. Sleeping in your...
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Massachusetts state lawmakers heard testimony earlier today about legislation that would make assaulting a police officer a felony. Right now, it's a misdemeanor. The legislation gained support following the death earlier this year of Auburn police officer Ronald Tarantino. He was shot and killed while responding to a traffic stop in May, and the shooter, Jorge Zambrano, had already been in court three times in the month leading up to the shooting. And it was including charges of assaulting a police officer. So supporters of this bill say this bill will protect police officers, but critics say it's not necessary. We've got one perspective here right now. We're joined by retired Plainville Police Chief Ned Merrick. He's also the Director of Governmental Affairs with the Massachusetts Fraternal Order of Police. And welcome to Radio Boston, Chief Merrick.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. You were on Beacon Hill today when this hearing was going on?
Yes, I testified.
What would these bills do, or this bill do, and why do you think it's an important bill to establish?
The governor's bill is House 4440. It basically establishes assault and battery on a police officer that results in serious bodily injury as a up to a 10-year felony. And while I agree with the basic premise of the bill, I disagree with the notion that in order for somebody to be charged with assault and battery on a police officer, that the officer has to suffer serious bodily injury in order for the felony provision to kick in.
So just to clarify, you want this to be a felony, this kind of assault, but it has to be, in your terms, an assault no matter what is a felony.
Yeah, an assault and battery. An assault is just like if I threaten you, that's an assault. If I point a gun at you and do nothing else, that's an assault. If I hit you with that gun, it's now assault and battery.
So there are two bills. Is there a difference that you'd want to point out in the legislation you heard today?
Well, both of the bills require serious bodily injury in order to charge for the felony. And my premise is that we shouldn't have to have serious bodily injury when a police officer is assaulted and battered. Bear in mind that probably 10 or 15 years ago, the Great and General Court passed legislation that made it a felony to assault and batter a firefighter. Now, I know that there's people that'll say, well, there's provisions in the statute. Generally, if one person assault and batters another with a dangerous weapon, that's a felony. And why can't you use that statute?
We want to hear that other side in just a minute. I do want to ask you if you know, Chief, if in other states there are laws that already describe this assault and battery as a felony.
I know that there are other states in which A and B on a police officer is a felony. I couldn't cite those for you right this minute because I'd have to do a little research.
But this is not coming out of its own vacuum. This
oh,
is something
no,
that
no.
exists.
As a matter of fact, there was a fellow that testified this morning at the hearing. While he didn't seem to disagree with the premise of the bill, he thought that actually acting on it was somewhat of a knee-jerk reaction in relation to the national dialogue that's going on right now. And he suggested that maybe we should take a step back, remove the passion, and think about this clearly. And when I offered my testimony, I refuted that by saying simply, because I've been a lobbyist for various police associations for close to 30 years, and I know from personal perspective that this concept of assault and battery on a PO being a felony has been filed for probably 25 years.
Okay, so Chief Merrick, I think that maybe the person that you were mentioning is Rasan Hall. He does have something to say here that is contrary to what you're laying out. He's the director of the Racial Justice Program for the ACLU of Massachusetts. He's the former assistant district attorney in Suffolk County, and he did say to lawmakers on Beacon Hill today that increasing penalties wouldn't deter people from assaulting officers.
This bill is about retribution and punishment. And as a society that has been suffering from retribution and punishment in the criminal justice system that has played out in racially disparate ways, we need to really consider the bill that is before us.
Chief Merrick, is this addressing the thing that you just mentioned, that some say there needs to be a pause here and to not be looking at assault and battery in this way right now?
Well, I don't disagree with what the previous speaker said. I take a little bit of umbrage at the notion that it's retribution. It's certainly punishment. But I think the other thing that he overlooked was the fact that the general laws are not only designed to punish the offender, but they're also designed to provide a guide for reasonable behavior and set boundaries for bad behavior. And the fact that you pass a law that says we're going to increase from misdemeanor to felony the act of committing an assault and battery on a police officer could very well provide an incentive for someone that might be inclined to do it because it's only a misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. It might slow them down and give them pause to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, sir. In this has been, you know, an incredibly hard week for police officers in the United States. After last week's shooting, I had the time yesterday to be listening to the memorial in Texas, and I wonder if you can talk about how what you're hearing from police this week and how they're feeling and if they're feeling afraid.
I don't think so much afraid, but what my fear is. Is that the police will step back from performing functions that they're supposed to be performing for fear of retribution or somebody saying, "Oh, you stepped over the line, you're out of here," and things like that. And so that's what my fear is. I frankly, after having been a cop for 40 years, I don't think I'd want to be a cop today in this environment. Because there is very much of a us against them attitude. And frankly, it plays on both sides.
Okay. There is something more there to talk about for sure in the field of law enforcement. I want to thank you for coming on today. I know it was a last-minute moment. So thank you so much, retired Plainville Police Chief Ned Merrick, also Director of Governmental Affairs with the Massachusetts Fraternal Order of Police.
Thank you.
Let's move on now to the latest in the legal fallout from Deflategate. Today, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit denied Tom Brady's request for a rehearing on the NFL's game suspension ruling. So, a reminder, if you're not following this blow by blow, in April, three appeals court judges ruled that NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell was within his power when he suspended Brady for his alleged role in deflating footballs during a 2015 playoff game that some say the Pats would have won no matter what, with a tire tube or something even. Joining us by phone right now to talk about where this could go from here is sports attorney Alan Milstein, who's been following this case and Only a Game's Bill Littlefield. Hello to both of you.
Hi, Jill.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. Thank you, Alan. Alan, the NFL Players Association says the commissioner made a, quote, clear violation of the collective bargaining agreement. And so right now, is there anywhere but up from here from this court into the Supreme Court?
No, that's the only place to go. But first, of course, Mr. Brady has to get a stay of the suspension, which he, I'm sure, will apply for this week. First, he's going to apply to the Second Circuit, and then he's going to apply probably just to Justice Ginsburg. And if he can stay the suspension, then they can file a petition for cert to the Supreme Court in 90 days or so.
Could you just clarify what that means, to stay the suspension?
Well, right now, with the Second Circuit en banc denying the review, Mr. Brady would be suspended for the first four games of the season. So in order to get heard by the Supreme Court to have that hearing mean anything, he has to get the court to say, or let's stay the suspension so it won't take place, it won't be enforced until after Mr. Mm-hmm. Brady has a chance to ask the Supreme Court to hear his appeal.
Right. And then if the Supreme Court decides that the NFL is correct in their decision, he then could be suspended those four games.
Well, that's assuming that the Supreme Court accepts the case.
Right. I didn't mean to jump ahead that much, but I do want to follow through on that. That meaning it's not that it is a temporary thing if the Supreme Court even took this interest in this.
That's right.
So what
that's
is the chance
right.
that they, you know, that they're going to hear this appeal?
Well, I mean, typically your chances are never very good of getting a hearing in the Supreme Court. You know, it's maybe 10%. You know, but this is a case that certainly has caught the public eye. It's a case that the Supreme Court has an interest in because the real issue in the case is the fairness of the arbitration process. And the Supreme Court has an interest in making sure that people trust the integrity of the arbitration process. And the other thing going for Mr. Brady is that his new counsel, Mr. Olson, is somebody that the court knows very well. He's probably argued as many cases before the Supreme Court as anyone. And there are some people who have filed amicus briefs, friends of the court brief, like Mr. Feinberg, who the Supreme Court also knows very well. So I think Brady has a better chance than most to get the Supreme Court to hear the case.
I want to build back in the spring. You asked NPR's Nina Totenberg to comment on the possibility of Deflategate reaching the high court. I'd like to play the tape of what she said.
There are some justices who basically say the letter of the law is the letter of the law. You agreed to the contract. Goodell was within his rights, and you have no rights under this contractual provision. Then there's another way to look at it. People who are strongly in favor of individual rights might say you do have certain rights to your reputation and the way you make your living, and they can't be ceded. Liberals and conservatives might be on either side.
So, Alan Milstein, sports attorney, what are the wider implications of this case if Brady files an appeal, it's accepted for other athletes, but as importantly for labor law, which is very much what this is in part about?
I mean, I think the ramifications of this case go far beyond just athletes. You know, every one of us signs contracts that have arbitration clauses in them. You may not even know it. I mean, it may be in your insurance policy, it may be in your mortgage, it may be in your lease, it may be in the contract of employment that you have. And the myth behind arbitration clauses is that, one, everybody, that if you've signed the contract, you know about it and you've agreed to it, which of course isn't true. But the other myth is that don't worry, because an arbitration process is just as fair as a court hearing. And that's really where this case has broad ramifications, because I don't think there's any question that the hearing that Brady had was not fair. You know, it was decided over by the same person who issued the punishment in the first place. So how could it be fair?
Mm-hmm. Bill Littlefield, what's your take on this as you watch sports across the board?
My worry, well, what I hope will happen in the long run is the people who are running the National Football Players Union will never sign such a stupid contract again, where they gave the kind of power to the commissioner that they did, where he gets to be judge and jury and executioner. But in terms of the implications for labor beyond football, there's a terrible irony, isn't there, that a multi-million dollar laborer comes to represent the interests of labor in general.
Right. That is quite profound. And we'll see if it all plays out. Alan Milstein, thank you so much for joining us today, a sports attorney based in New Jersey and following this case. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Bill, don't go anywhere. So the Patriots open their season September 11th in Arizona. And if the suspension goes through for Tom Brady, it's likely that, or it is the fact that backup quarterback Jimmy Garoppolo will take his place. So what does that mean for the season as it starts?
Nobody knows. the backup quarterback, Jimmy Garoppolo, has played so little that I don't think anybody is able to extrapolate anything regarding his performance in the future based on his performance in the past.
Well, that's hard to believe. I mean, they must know.
He's barely been on the field.
What do you think of him? Talented?
I have no idea. I haven't a clue. I mean, I assume he's talented because the Patriots know how to do their business, and they drafted him, and they've been employing him as a backup quarterback for a couple of years. But he really has had so little game experience that nobody knows. Now, this may be one of these absolutely wonderful stories where he steps in and throws six touchdown passes in four games in a row and breaks all the records and everything else. From time to time, this happens.
It's Echo Sema's story about a Hollywood starlet being discovered, right?
Absolutely. So, you know, she's, hey, the star is sick. Right, you got to go on. It's okay. Don't worry about it. I know all the lines.
Are there any other options besides Garoppolo?
Not that I'm aware of right now. I mean, he's the only guy that anybody's been talking about. So I suppose anything could happen in the wonderful world of trade. I mean, maybe they'll find somebody in a semi-pro league somewhere if he tweaks a knee. But no, I think he's the guy, and everybody's got their fingers crossed and hoping for the best.
All right. There are other things going on in the world of sports, and because you're here, we want to make sure we hear about them. Is it true that this is normally the dead part of the sports calendar this time of year?
It's traditionally characterized that way, Jill, but you know, you have a women's soccer league going on, you have the WNBA season going on, so I think it's a little bit troglodytic to characterize it as
season. I'm glad to hear that. I don't want to make any assumptions, but it is interesting.
MLS is also
And WBNA. Yeah. We have a crossover, though, also, again, of American political life leading into sports, or American cultural life. During the Canadian National Anthem at last night's MLB All-Star Game, we heard this.
In all thy sons' command, we're all brothers and sisters, all lives matter to the
Do you want to explain what was changed there?
Yeah, there was a lyric change by one member of a group called the Tenors, and the other three members of the Tenors looked askance at the guy who had single-handedly changed the lyrics and inserted the phrase, "All Lives Matter." Of course, the problem with the phrase, "All Lives Matter," is that it has become so fraught with baggage. Black Lives Matter is a cry of anguish, a cry of despair, and All Lives Matter has been interpreted as a kind of anti-Black Lives Matter sentiment, and this is very much what the response has been to this particular singer's decision.
I want to ask you to respond to another response that came out from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Reported that this past weekend that four police officers who were off duty were doing, you know, security detail at in Minneapolis at a WNBA game, and they saw that several Minnesota Lynx players were wearing shirts that said many things. It said, "Change starts with us," "Justice and accountability." It also, on the back, the shirts had Philando Castile's name and Alton Sterling's name, along with Black Lives Matter and a Dallas Police Department emblem. What do you make of those security detail leaving?
I think it was they weren't paying enough attention to what the players were trying to do. The players were basically, I think, trying to say, we need to stop violence, no matter whether it's violence against black motorists or black pedestrians or black people outside of convenience stores, or it's violence against police officers trying to do their job in a peaceful way, marching alongside peaceful demonstrators. It would be better if everybody recognized that the kind of violence that we've seen against African Americans is not obviously to be addressed by violence against police officers. Violence only begets more violence.
Right, and but on the court, this is playing out there. It will play out in other places, I imagine, and hopefully we will hear your folks reporting on this on Only a Game.
Hard
NPR's
to
Only
avoid
Game.
At this point, Jill.
Right,
yes.
Exactly. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, airs Saturday on WBUR. This Saturday, every Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Imagine this, getting a terse email from your estranged father with the subject line, changes. Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Susan Faludi got exactly that mail, and in it, her father announced that he had undergone surgery in Thailand. He was now a she, going by the name Steffi, and at age 76, he wrote to his daughter, "I have decided that I have had enough of impersonating a macho, aggressive man that I have never been inside." And then her father asked her daughter to tell her story. Susan Faludi said yes, and that is the topic of her new book, In the Dark Room. She joins us now from the studios of Maine Public Broadcasting in Portland. Susan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
This is a very different book than others that you've written, like Backlash. You're known as a big bad feminist, right? And in many ways, still. This is a very personal memoir.
I don't
memoir.
Know about the bad part, okay. But...
Powerful. Your book is very personal. It's very revealing. It's historical as well. When you got that email from your father, you hadn't been in touch for years. Did hearing from him at that time in your mind, and he was still a man, surprise you?
Absolutely. It was pretty much of a bolt from the blue, and got some. It took some getting used to. And I had, I had thought I had my father pegged as the sort of hyper-masculine patriarch and autocrat. That was my experience growing up.
When was the last time you had heard from him? Before you even, you saw the email Dad wrote to you. When had you heard from him before then?
Well, we would exchange kind of perfunctory emails on occasion and saw each other at, a few family functions, a graduation, a wedding, that sort of thing. But we really weren't in real communication for 25 years.
Okay.
Ever since my parents' divorce in 1977.
So then, of course, you read this email and you find out that your father has become a woman surgically. You ended up having a very tender relationship with him, as I read it, in the last dozen years of his life, embodied with many contradictions still. But I wondered if you would read something from your book, from In the Dark Room, that's sort of at the beginning. It's a passage on page 46, I believe, we flagged, to let people know where this begins in some way.
Yes. This was not a tender moment. This was
no,
at the
this
beginning.
This was not a tender moment.
on my first visit, and actually the first day of my visit. Suzanne, come here. She was standing before a dressing table with a mirror framed in vanity lights. I recognized it, the makeup table for fashion models that used to sit in my father's photo studio in Manhattan. She held an outfit in each hand, a yellow sundress with flounces and a navy blue frock with a sailor suit collar. Which should I wear? I said I didn't know and thought petulantly, change your clothes all you want. You're still the same person. It's hot out. I'll wear the sundress. She started peeling off her top. I backed toward the door. Where are you going? To unpack, I said. Oh, come now, she said, half in, half out of her blouse. We're all women here. She pulled the top over her head and gestured toward the closet. Help me pick out the shoes to go with the dress. I stood in the threshold, 1 foot in, 1 foot out. My father gave me a familiar half grin. Come closer. I won't bite.
So this is 2004. And as you said, you've just reconnected. Could you unbundle this a little bit? You wrote, you're still the same person. That's the thought that went through your head. Do you mean the same violent person, the same erratic person, the person who wasn't in your life? And who was he before this moment over those 25 years of estrangement?
Yes. You're still the same person was the key passage, because the truth was I had a lot easier time adjusting to my father's gender change than dealing with all the ghosts of our shared past. The real anxiety wasn't my father's appearance, but our whole history. And the come closer, I won't bite led me to remember that in the past he did metaphorically and bite.
He physically hurt you.
It was very violent in toward my mother and toward all of us in various ways toward the end of my parents' marriage. You know, when threats and browbeating didn't work, my father sought to prevent the divorce through physical violence. Mm-hmm. And even just growing up, my father always had this sort of underlying smoldering anger, and we tiptoed around him a great deal. We were afraid of him because we never knew when he would erupt.
I don't mean to make an assumption, but is it the journalist in you that got you on a plane to go see him? Because why? Because that's what drives us, right? And sometimes, why did you get on the plane and go to Budapest? Which is where
he was. Well, you know, the journalist and the daughter and the feminist, I think they all for different reasons wanted to be done with this endless estrangement. I mean, the daughter wanted to know her father. I didn't want this to continue on. I wanted to know who was this person. I think, as we all do, who is this parent that I grew up with in close quarters and never really knew? And I mean, that was a great gift on the part of my father to invite me back mm-hmm. into her life. It's kind of every grown child's fantasy that you get another crack at it and get to figure out who is this mystery person.
Mm. Before I want to ask you a lot more about who he was, what he concealed, but I just want to understand, there was love in your family as much as, you know, can be love in a lot of places where there's also violence and deceit. But did you love your father at that point?
Did I love my father at the point when I first came back?
At 2004.
Well, I think yes. I mean, I think.
And up, and, you know, I mean, growing up.
Yes. I mean, and one tends to, in looking back, to kind of level things out and sort of, you know, remember the few points that were the kind of disastrous ones. But there were, of course, there were periods of fondness and amusement and delight and humor. They were overshadowed by the sort of apocalyptic end of the family. My father and I, when I was growing up, did a lot of things together. They were often in the service of the various sort of roles that my father kind of serially adopted. My father brought me along on many of those pursuits, and many of them were kind of hyper masculine ones. My father was the kind of ultra mountaineer. We went rock climbing and rappelling. My father and I took a long marathon bicycle trip through the Swiss Alps. And my father was also a kind of engine, you know, technically sophisticated, and so we built shortwave radios and remote control airplanes. So there's a lot I learned from my father as well.
And you saw him as a manly man, as you said, in some ways. I don't mean to paraphrase, but this is mm-hmm. in contrast to some of the things that he began to share with you as you began to write about him over those years. Your father concealed a lot. He concealed much of his experience in the war in Hungary as a Jew. He had to hide. He had to hide to survive. So did his parents. He hid things in the photos that he worked on, right? He fixed things. He touched them up and made them blemish-free, I imagine. I wonder I have a funny question, in a way. Did you ever see him naked? You start to write about that. Did you ever see her fully naked? Because it's the ultimate reveal, in a way.
Yeah, in the early period, after my father's gender reassignment surgery, I would say the first few visits, my father, you know, sort of would let the robe open. It was part of, I think, my father's thrill and of, you know, I finally have the body that I always thought I should have. But she got over that. Thankfully.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it was a show, perhaps. You know, yes. Did your father see himself, herself, as a Jew when she lived as a man in the United States?
Well, this was one of one of many paradoxes in my family. My father's life was sort of a series of these identity reinventions. So here's my father, who grew up first as a very, you know, privileged only child of wealthy Jewish Orthodox parents in Budapest. Then the war comes. My father's a teenager, and my father is basically an urchin on the street, doing his best to survive, and by passing as a Christian with only false identity papers and a stolen fascist armband.
And where are his parents at this point?
His parents were first. My grandmother was in what was called a Yellow Star house, which was kind of a this attempt to ghettoize Budapest Jews in preparation for deporting them. And then they were in a protected house, a Swiss protected house, for a while, which then got invaded by fascist Hungarian Arrow Cross officers. Mm-hmm. And my father, and this is one of the stories I really late in the book, my father, wearing this armband and a rifle with no bullets in it, was able to rescue them right before the invasion, because he had gotten word of it, simply by marching in and impersonating an Arrow Cross officer. Mm-hmm. But then to answer your question about what happened when my father eventually gets to the U.S. and I am, you know, my father's raising a family, all traces of being Jewish were pretty much expunged. We celebrated Christmas. We celebrated Easter. My father always insisted on a very elaborate Christmas with every year it was another kind of theme, a Swedish Christmas, a German Christmas,
and
elaborate
when
food.
When he was still in Hungary, the family changed its last name from Friedman to Faludi. Is that when
That's
he was
right.
still a teenager?
Right. And my father actually chose the name Faludi. So this is in 1946, right after the war. And you got to keep in mind that more than a half million Hungarian Jews were killed in the course of the war, with the complicity and enthusiastic participation of the Hungarian government, the gendarmes, the police. One in three Jews killed in Auschwitz were Hungarian.
I want to ask you about something that you pointed out that I think I understood this, that there was a Nazi propaganda message that Jewish men were weak, they were feminine. Your father must have seen that. You saw that possibly on posters or in exhibits, photos even. I don't know. In your research, you may have learned this. Yet he himself became this woman, this Jewish man became a woman. How much of that is a piece of a foundation of how this all came down?
Well, it was fascinating and horrifying to read of this long ancient equation of Jewish men with feminization, going back to the medieval period, to the extreme of casting Jewish men as men who menstruated. This is just very deep in the European soil of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. As far as my father goes, the traumatic experience she had as a hunted Jew during the war infused every experience in her life. But it wasn't like the Holocaust was a switch that flipped my father's gender. My father did talk about how being able to pass as a Christian during the war was sort of training she used in passing as a woman later on. So she made those kind of connections. And I think those, the gender identity and not so much the Jewish identity as dealing with anti-Semitism were forms of otherness that operated in her life and that were in conversation in complicated ways.
Mm. Did you have any conversations with him about what she likes about being a woman. And did you have conversations together, like a mother and daughter, about being a woman and something you shared? Did it ever get there?
Yeah. Oh, yes. And we disagreed rather vehemently
as
about what it meant to
too,
be
right?
a woman. And my father said to me pointedly at one point, "Well, you just talk about meaning my in your books. You talk about all the disadvantages of being a woman, and I see only advantages. You know, men open doors for me now. Men kiss my hand, which is a sort of vintage Hungarian mm-hmm. expression of a gentleman to a woman. Mm-hmm. You know, they I don't have to lift a finger now. I think a part of this was put on. I mean, my father was very handy and continued to fix most things around the house. But one aspect that my father was able to use in a really beneficial way was her belief that as a woman she she could allow herself to be more open and that she could allow herself to express some emotion. She often said to me, you know, as a man I couldn't communicate and now I can talk to anyone. Mm. And that was a great thing.
When did she move back to Hungary, to Budapest?
In 1990, so right after the transition from communism to capitalism, okay. a period that, by the way, is called the change in Hungary, which is just what my father called her gender reassignment.
Right. And there has, you know, there's been continued concern there, political unrest and return of, you know, violence at the gay pride parade you wrote about. This was, as you said, going on while your father changed also.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, but she said to you over and over, right, that she felt accepted there versus maybe the U.S., I don't know.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's one of my eternal questions of why my father went back and whether my father went back to fit in as, you know, a quote-unquote 100% Hungarian patriot, as she presented herself, or whether she went back to thumb her nose at a culture that had tried to annihilate our family. And I, you know, I think as in all questions, it's both. But it was, you know, the whole time I was there, I was very aware that I was witnessing not one but two identity searches. I mean, my father's on the gender front, but Hungary's quest for a national identity. And it was a real cautionary tale. Watching what was going on in Hungary, how that identity quest can go awry in a really ugly way.
Well, I want to maybe suggest that there was a third, a third that you observed, which is, you know, what did you find out about yourself here in those years as a woman, as a feminist, as an American? You know, when you stand naked in your own mirror, what do you see now? What's your identity?
Well, you know. My identity, I have to say that, I mean, one thing I came to understand more is how my identity is not just about me. I mean, there's a kind of modern insistence in talking about identity these days that which is almost egocentric. It's about, you know, your identity is individual and internal. It's what you choose. But so much of who we are is forged in those external collective connections. And I think, you know, for me, reconnecting to my father and to my father's culture, I was able to become more myself. I was able to know the history that shaped me through my father. I was able to sort of put myself in a much larger social mm-hmm. and political context.
You saw so much more than you imagined you would have probably, you know, once you stopped connecting. So we have only a couple of minutes left, and I want to mention something, and I want to ask you a bigger picture, but I want to make sure that people, listeners, hear about that you went back to his apartment with him. Just a coincidence that he may have looked up the address and he found out it was a Reform synagogue. And he wrote his accent into your text, like he had these very long A's, like Suzanne. And how did he speak? Can you give us his voice? And I don't want to miss the moment that, you know, this synagogue is an incredible moment.
Right. Well, then this is just Hungarian. The vowels get drawn out. So, and that's one thing I learned going back to Hungary. Some of the things I thought were odd about my father, I realized, well, they're just Hungarian, such as the way my father would say, you know, hello, which was hello. But one of the struggles between my father and me over the years after we reconnected was I kept wanting to go back to the sort of historic touchstones, the, you know, where he grew up, the synagogue he went to. And my father, she was always saying, no, that's ancient history. That's how I used to be, and I'm no longer that person. But over time, my father became more and more interested in her family history and wanting to revisit it. And I was constantly pushing her to go to one of the apartment building where she grew up. My grandfather owned these two luxury apartment buildings in Budapest. One day my father called me and I was about to come to visit in Budapest and she said, guess what? There's this Reform synagogue that has set up shop in one of the apartments in my father's old building. Maybe we could go there. And in fact, it was so reformed that the first woman ever to be a rabbi in Hungary was the rabbi of this Reform congregation. At any rate, when we went over there, we're standing in front of the door, and my father has this intake of breath, and he realizes that this was the very apartment where my father, as a teenager, and my grandfather hid out in the summer of 1944. It was an apartment that belonged to a doctor who was a Christian doctor who was going mm-hmm. on vacation, and so they hid all that summer. And it was while they were there that they heard on BBC that my grandfather's family that lived in the country had been deported to Auschwitz.
Had you gone back to this synagogue a few times, or did you just go that once?
Well, my father just went that once, which, mm-hmm. believe me, was a great triumph, getting yeah. my father to return to any place. But I went back to this building repeated times and actually mm-hmm. interviewed the family that lived in the apartment building where my father grew up. And many other spots in the sort of constellation of my father's
development. And through that, it really sounds like you, as you said, you saw what he had lived through in his younger years. You saw where he came from, which is beautiful, and how that shaped her life. It's funny. I am going back and forth between he and she. She is she died a woman in the hospital in 2015 in the woman's wing, as you wrote, which you were glad about. It sounded very sweet because you weren't by his side. We have just a couple of moments left. I do want to ask you.
Actually, I was there.
Oh, you were there. I'm sorry.
I was there at the end.
At the end. I apologize.
Yes. Yeah. But the women in the ward were very mm-hmm. kind to her, mm-hmm. and I was grateful for that.
Yeah. There was a touch on your back, I believe. Maybe it was your arm. I apologize. Yes. But there was a touch. Somebody reached over to you. At the yes. core of this being a memoir, right? This is for you, as we talked about, a story about identity. But it's who you are, Susan Faludi. You know, you can't get away without talking about the culture that we live in. Maybe even right now. Where do you take all of this from here when we go into this, if I may, Derek, jump into the election year, into where we are now in race relations? I mean, this is about identity. So much of when we vote, it's about identity. When we protest, it's for or against, it's about identity. So what can you tell us? Where can you leave us with this?
Well, you know, that was the other remarkable experience I had in investigating my father's stories, that it came to mean more than one idiosyncratic tale to me. I mean, my father in a way, is a kind of identity zealot. You know, when her struggles on a lot of fronts, gender, national, religious, political, get to the core of something our culture is really struggling with right now, which is, what is the nature of identity? Right. Is it what we choose, or is it the one thing we can't escape? And we're seeing that all over, whether it's Brexit or Trump's Make America Great Again or ISIS or LGBT rights.
Right. I would like to go on and hear this list, Susan Faludi, and maybe we can get you back, or maybe this is what you write about next. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Susan Faludi is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, a lecturer at Bowdoin College, and her latest book that we've been talking about is In the Dark Room. You can find more information at our website, radioboston.org. And I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Awesome. The new Ghostbusters movie, the reboot, is coming out Friday. It may look very familiar to Greater Bostonians because while the movie is set in New York City, the majority of the film was made around Boston. And we are sure that you may have spotted some familiar hangouts, but not all of them, especially a particular classroom location where Kristen Wiig's character, who is a particle physicist, reveals on a whiteboard that she is standing in front of her life's work, and it's complicated equations. And, you know, if I walked by it, I'd wipe that marker right off by mistake. Well, they are real equations and real science in a movie about ghosts, and that real classroom is based on one inside of MIT. The equations written out for Wiig were written out by Lindley Winslow, who's here. She's a professor of physics at MIT. Welcome.
Thank you.
So these equations we'll get to in a moment. They're not your science background, but you wrote these out. You gave them to some props person, and they turned it into this whiteboard. You gave Wiig the credential, I think, you know, to make audiences believe that there might be some true science behind ghost busting. Is there?
There is. So what you see up on that whiteboard is a real theory. It's actually based on a theory by a professor from Harvard. It's called SU5, and it's the first theory of almost everything, or the most simple theory of almost everything. And so I thought that would be good for theoretical particle physics as an introduction to her work as a more formal string theorist.
Right. Does she? You haven't seen the movie yet because it hasn't come out yet.
I haven't got a chance to see it yet.
So we'll have to see how she uses this. How did you get involved in this as a particle physicist in Hollywood?
So it ends up that I was an assistant professor at UCLA for 2 years, and there is Professor David Salzberg, who's the science advisor for the Big Bang Theory. And he is sort of a clearinghouse now of anyone that wants physics goes to him. And so he sent them to Boston, and I interacted mainly with the props and set dressing, and they're like, we need to know what a real physics lab looks like. Well, I'm like, I have real physics labs. And so they came to visit, and it all started from there.
Okay, so what do you do usually day-to-day?
So day-to-day, I am a neutrino physicist. I'm an experimental neutrino physicist. So this was fun kind of pretending to be a theoretical physicist for a minute.
Oh, you know, for those of us who are not physicists, we don't know the difference.
Right. It's important to us.
Just speaking for myself here. You know, we've got this scene from the original Ghostbusters movie in 1984. Of course, some people are quite ticked off that there is a remake. It's not a remake. It's a very different thing. But let's listen to this with Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, discussing their first use of the proton pack.
You know, it's just occurred to me we really haven't had a completely successful test of this equipment.
I blame myself.
So do I.
Well, no sense worrying about it now.
Why worry? Each of us is wearing an unlicensed nuclear accelerator on his back.
Yep.
How real is this idea, Lindley Winslow from MIT?
So we know how to accelerate protons. So that idea is not that foreign. But normally we do it over about a kilometer wide ring or something of the sort. So putting it on your back is a little tricky. But one of the best updates was a postdoc at MIT, James Maxwell, who got to actually build some things for the set, updated the theory behind it. And now they have superconducting magnets. Mm-hmm. Granted, still hard to get it on the back, but it just needs a breakthrough in materials.
Uh-huh. And have you ever found a ghost at MIT?
Not that I know of.
Not that you know of. That's the thing about ghosts, right? Listen, we only have about a minute left. I have two daughters. Do you have a baby? Do you have a daughter?
I have a daughter.
Okay.
10 months.
So science.
She was on set, apparently.
Okay. Oh, wow. Girls, you know, this is pop culture that we're talking about, but there's the whole STEM movement pushing women into science, pushing kids into science, but women too, women as engineers, women as physicists. What do you make about the role that you played here? And do you think that actually there's gonna, that's going to filter out at all? That girls will watch this and go, ah. Oh.
That's why I took the time. It was a busy summer last time, as I said. I was very pregnant to do this, in that Ghostbusters gives you that idea of what it is to be a scientist and puts that seed in the little girl's
may
head.
May it bloom for all of them. Lindley Winslow is an assistant professor of physics at MIT, and she was one of the scientists that helped advise the new Ghostbusters movie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Jill Kaufman. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston. Mm-hmm.